Welcome to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James. This is my new time slot, moved from Sunday nights at 6. So I hope to have you as a continuing listener at this new hour. The topic of my show tonight is ethics, and it's not the first time I've approached the topic. Ethics, of course, concerns itself with figuring out what the right thing to do is in any given situation. And it seems an unfashionable concern in this day and age when our leader boasts about not paying income taxes, says it's clever, doesn't realize that it might be clever for him, but not so clever for the rest of us that bank on community money to keep everything in our lives going. Of course, it's no fun to pay taxes, but how else do we finance things? We could go back to the old days and not have money be in the equation at all, I guess. Just barter everything. But I'm not sure that's legal anymore. Anyway, I was inspired to have another go at discussing ethics by a column I read called The Ethicist. And it's a question and answer thing that people write in with their dilemmas, and the ethicist, in this case a Mr. Appiah, comes up with answers to their ethical questions. So, this particular question that caught my eye said, is it okay to press your spouse to have a vasectomy before you ditch him? That was how they titled the question. This was written in not by the spouse who planned to ditch her husband as soon as he'd had the vasectomy, but by a friend of hers. And she writes this. Some time ago, a friend told me that she was planning to leave her husband, but was waiting for him to get a vasectomy. She said she knew she'd have to hold his hand through it to make sure it happened. Once the procedure was done, she planned to break the news that she was going to end the marriage. The writer in says, I was dumbfounded and told her that I was concerned that she'd chosen to pressure her husband to have a vasectomy before letting him know she was ending the marriage. She said she'd been mourning him for years that she was planning to leave, and so it shouldn't be a surprise. Furthermore, she felt that he could barely manage to parent the children they had, and that she didn't want him to be distracted by more kids. She later reported that when she told her husband of her decision to end the marriage for good, he told her he was upset to learn this after having had the vasectomy, and that he believed it would hurt his chances of finding a new partner. Her response was that she was pretty sure that women weren't going to be interested in having children with someone his age anyway. He's middle-aged. This woman is employed by an organization dedicated to reproduction choice and plans to work as a counselor. I've been troubled about what she told me for months and have considered disclosing the information to the organization. But I'm unsure. Would I just be tattling on what I find to be reprehensible human behavior? Or would this be a reasonable act in response to the highly inappropriate behavior of someone working in the field of reproductive choice? Please advise. Name withheld. So, listener, what do you think the ethicist's answer was? I will read it to you now on this The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. He writes, your friend treated her spouse in an appallingly manipulative way. She believed that he wouldn't have made the decision to have a vasectomy if he'd known she was ending the marriage for good, and she withheld this information in order to get him to do what she thought was best. That's a case study in disrespect. People have the right to make the central decisions in their own life in the light of their best understanding of the situation. And she denied him his best understanding. That she judged he was a lousy father and thus shouldn't have more children did not give her the right to manipulate him in this way, any more than it would have given her the right to make him infertile by sneaking something into his food, even though there are intricate and costly procedures for reversing vasectomies. Still, they're not guaranteed to work. He tells the writer in, what you really want to know, of course, is whether this behavior shows her to be unfit to occupy her position at a reproductive rights non-profit or to take up a career as a counselor. He says, I presume this woman discussed these matters with you on the assumption that your relationship meant that you would treat the information as private. So to disclose to others what she told you would be to betray the relationship and ignore her understanding of what it entailed. Besides, there's a person better placed to make such a complaint than you, namely the husband she's divorcing. The ethicist writes that he understands the writer's urge to intervene. What her friend did is not just immoral, but also in contravention of her employer's mission. He writes, "You might worry that her failure to respect the reproductive autonomy of her husband derives from a generalized contempt for the reproductive autonomy of others. But there's a significant body of research in social psychology suggesting that our conduct in one type of situation often doesn't generalize to others. You can be an honest broker and a dishonest husband. That someone has done something awful in the context of a difficult marriage, then, doesn't prove her to be an awful person in every other respect. And it certainly doesn't establish that she'd be unable to discharge her professional obligations. Thinking that you can manipulate your about-to-be ex-husband's choices doesn't entail thinking that it's okay to do the same with a client." He continues, "There's a natural tendency to want people to suffer for their wrongdoings, but sometimes it isn't our job to make that happen." He says, "I'd leave this episode and this woman in your past." So, listener, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? That our conduct in one area doesn't necessarily translate to another. And it brings to mind this syndrome of cognitive dissonance, where we might know something is wrong, but still do it. And when it comes to not just ethical behavior towards others, which is the topic of my share in our tonight, that's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935, but even behaving badly towards ourselves. Smoking is an example that comes immediately to mind. The actual definition of cognitive dissonance is being able to hold two inconsistent attitudes at the same time, or actually doing something that's inconsistent with your own attitude toward it. In order to do that, you have to sort of justify your actions in some way, telling yourself even though you know it's wrong, it's right for you. This theory of cognitive dissonance was proposed by psychologist Leon Festinger, who started with an experiment where he asked students to help him do an extremely boring and repetitive manual task. Afterwards, he required of his students to each recruit another student to complete the same task, while telling them it was rather interesting. And as motivation for this lie, some students were offered $1 and others $20. Weirdly, those that were paid $20 to tell another student it was interesting, even though it wasn't, admitted to that student that they found it boring. But those paid only $1 tended to commit to the lie and say the task was quite interesting, really, more meaningful than they'd imagined. What was going on here was both sets of students, the ones paid $1 and the ones paid $20, had to justify telling the lie. Those who'd been paid a decent amount of money could tell themselves they did it for the money, but those who'd received the pittance couldn't say that, so they had to convince themselves that actually they hadn't really lied. They had, after all, found something interesting in the task they had to do. In that same spirit, parents often find that mild rebukes can stop disruptive behavior in children better than stronger ones. If you threaten a child with death and destruction if he crayons on the curtains, he may stop for a moment. Then he'll think, "I only stopped because I was forced to, but I still want to do it." However, if he's gently turned to some other activity, he's more likely to justify his compliance by saying, "Well, I didn't want a crayon on the curtains anyway, really." And there was the fried grasshopper experiment carried out in a military college where people were asked to eat fried grasshoppers. No one really wanted to, but when a pleasant man made the request and said it was completely voluntary, people did eat them. But most of them still disliked the fried grasshoppers after eating them. However, when an obnoxious man made the same request and he was rude to his assistant, so none of the participants liked him, they did claim to like the fried grasshoppers afterwards. And this was explained by the psychologist who conducted the experiment as part of cognitive dissonance theory. When the person conducting the experiment was a nice guy, the participants could justify their eating something unpleasant by telling themselves they did it because the man was nice enough that they wanted to help him. when the man wasn't nice and they didn't want to help him, the only way they could justify eating the grasshoppers was by saying that they were quite palatable, really. Psychologist Elliot Aronson has explained it thus. Dissonance theory does not rest upon the assumption that man is a rational animal. Rather, it suggests that man is a rationalizing animal, that he attempts to appear rational, not just to others, but also to himself. Funnily enough, using the same principle, researchers have found that a speaker who has low credibility can often sway an audience over to his side more easily than a speaker with all the right credentials and reputation. If, of course, the people in the audience have made an effort to get to hear him. Does this resonate for you in this day and age, listener? The reason behind this is if you're going to travel a long distance and then only disagree with that expert, it doesn't induce tension because the expert is usually considered to be worth hearing. But if you go out of your way to hear someone who has no standing and talks nonsense, that's harder to justify or reconcile with one's own idea of one's own intelligence. So to resolve the conflict that causes and the questioning of one's own integrity, we dig around and find something to agree with this speaker about. And it helps explain why some people who are converted to a belief hold on to it longer than others. Psychologist Martin Hoffman ran an experiment to test the role conformity had in how persistent one's conversion was. He tried to pressure a number of his students to change their attitudes on a particular topic, and 2 weeks later he tested them to see how many still held the same view and how many had reverted to their old view pre-conversion. He found that those who had a high need to conform came up with the lower conversion scores than those who were more non-conforming. And that led him to the conclusion that the longer someone resists altering their position under pressure conditions, the longer they retain the altered position in the post-pressure conditions. Which leads one to believe that the longer one resists changing a position, the more one has to square that position within oneself by believing it all the more wholeheartedly. All interesting psychological stuff, isn't it, listener? I think we always knew that in order to conduct ourselves badly, we had to find a way to justify it, which hopefully, conversely, means that our instinct is to behave well, that that's the more natural. Ethics is the topic on my Share Now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. And speaking of cognitive dissonance, there's a certain amount of cognitive dissonance that goes into our attitude toward climate change, obviously. I think by now we all know about fossil fuels and that climate change is a real thing, and we humans, with our greedy use of diminishing resources, are responsible for many of the changes that are happening. Because it's overwhelming to so many, a lot of us just try to put it out of our minds and justify it because of the conveniences in our lives that we would need to forego. But some very civic conscious people are doing more than just paying it lip service. One of them is my friend Nikki Smart, who used to live in Laguna and now lives in Los Angeles. She, along with another friend and Lagunan, Tammy Arnold, who has been working closely with Al Gore and his sustainability-oriented investment company, recently attended his 3-day training seminar on climate control. So I asked Nikki to share her experience of it with us here on KX935's The Share In Hour. So who was actually at this? What kinds of people attended this?
Well, they had 2,200 people from all over the world. So people had flown in. This was amazing to me because I'm from South Africa. I met a group that had come in from Johannesburg. They had just arrived. They had come straight to the conference. They were going to do their 3 days of conference and then fly back home, which is huge because it's, you know, almost a 30-hour flight.
So they'd arrived the day before yesterday.
I mean, they're poor things. They must have been so jet-lagged.
What sort of age were they?
They were young. They were probably in their late 20s, and they were part of a group called Global Shapers from India, from Japan. I mean, they were really people from all over the world.
Had they organized themselves?
Some of them came in groups. I think some of them had just paid for themselves. Some of them had been funded, just for their travel expenses. But mostly it was just individuals. each got your name tag, and it had a little color on it, and the color indicated where you were from. So if you were red, that meant you were from, you're an international person. If you were yellow, you were from the Los Angeles area. If you were blue, you were from California, but just not Los Angeles area. So they had them divided. It was very well organized. Alan Horn, the head of Walt Disney, his wife funded the whole thing. We had food, it was catered, we had, you know, coffee all the time for 3 days, and actually have the convention center available to us. And they had all these different panels, which were really interesting, with really smart people.
And Gore appeared in person for the whole
time? Gore was there
time.
For the entire time. He's amazing, because he, you know, he gives these like 2 hour talks, and then he's mingling with everyone, and then he's doing the moderating the panels. And yeah, he was very, very much a part of it.
And is he inspirational?
He's incredibly inspirational. And every time he came on stage, people just stood up and applauded. And he's eventually like, don't. And he was like, I'm not even going to leave the stage anymore, because every time I come on. And the panels were great. You get to see that there's a lot of very smart people out there that are really trying to get on top of the situation. So that's comforting.
Give us an example of the panels that appealed to you most.
Well, the one I found the most interesting was the one with the entertainment industry, and was the head of Walt Disney, who said that he has lunch with Jerry Seinfeld at least once a year. And he said, I'm always amazed, because we'll go to some restaurant and people just come up and go, Jerry, as if they know him. And he goes, I know they don't know him, they just think they know him because they've seen him in their living room every night for years and years. And he said, so the biggest thing you can do to get attention for climate change is to have, you know, Seinfeld putting solar panels on his roof or driving an electric car. And he says, and if you make all the heroes and the people that, you know, the audience is watching all the time, make them be aware of climate change, make them be doing things for this, then people start to go, oh, this is normal. This is what everyone does. And it normalizes it and makes it that everyone wants to now start doing that as well.
So good for Seinfeld.
Well, I don't know if he's doing it right.
We don't know if he's doing it. I think just having a different currency in the world than money is what we need right now. You know, mm-hmm. We need to know that good behavior is better than being super rich or being super famous. And somebody that is super famous can really bring that message across.
Yes, they can.
We see that their dedication is to something other than their nebulous fame,
right,
that came a little bit uninvited. And what they choose to do with their lives when they have a high profile is really important.
I think so too. And I think if you already have that platform, then yes, please use it.
Exactly.
Use that voice. Yeah, we had the leader of the hip hop caucus, who was fantastic and so eloquent and so well spoken. And I think it was him that said, I can put 3 scientists on the stage and they can tell you all about climate change. But if I put Beyonce on the stage, then you're going to actually listen. And
that's right.
And it's true.
You're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. My topic tonight is ethics. Doing the right thing, or the philosophy of attempting to do the right thing. And I'm currently talking to my friend and former Laguna, Nikki Smart, who attended a 3-day seminar given by Al Gore on climate change. I wanted to know what inspired her.
I've been worried about it since I was young. I don't know why. I've always tried to save as much water as possible. Like when I shower now, I have a bucket in there, and then I use the grey water to go water my lemon tree. I've always brought my own bags for shopping, even before I gave up plastic bags. It's just something that's always been in my conscience. I wish I wasn't, actually, because it's a bit of a burden and it stresses me out. I think I didn't realize what a situation we were in. I mean, I knew it existed. I knew it was sort of coming, but I didn't pay it any real attention.
But you did in your little way, because
yes,
you did your own thing,
yes,
all your life.
But I realise that we all have to step up now.
Thing is, I think everyone has a slight apocalyptical view anyway at the moment, because
right,
of
yes,
the way we're hurtling towards so much that we're not quite ready for and prepared.
Yeah.
A friend of mine actually at the station has this app that monitors his sleep patterns. And it's rather wonderful, because it shows that he had, you know, 7 hours that night, 8 hours that night, that his average for the week was 7.48, that he had so much REM sleep, that he had so much tossing and turning. And I said, does it not bother you that this unknown corporation is in your brain while you're sleeping? He said, no, why should it bother me? And it didn't occur to him.
But for those of us that those things do occur to, we're going into pastures so unknown in every area of our existence these days that I think people have just basically thrown up their arms and say, I can't cope with it. I'm going to watch Hallmark movies. Mm-hmm. I do. And I'm an inquisitive person, a curious person, but I can't bear it.
I know it does. It feels like we're living in a horror movie right now.
We're living in a world that I don't quite recognize, you know, and I don't quite know where we're trying to take ourselves, to be honest. It's 1984 gone completely.
No, I agree.
Nuts.
It's quite terrifying. We're in a hell of a spot.
I think we are, and I think that's why people, they're not reacting because it just, it's
too much.
They're overwhelmed, as you say. And that's why I think if somebody just came along quietly and said, instead of being so corporate in our lives now, which we are, I did a whole show on, like, we have four companies ruling the world,
the whole place,
that everything is about money, where we're selling billions of dollars of arms to Saudi Arabia, so we can't tell them off for doing something completely heinous. We need to change the currency. We need to have moral, good behavior, proper behavior, people doing the right thing, being something that we're all trying to aim for, rather than being the richest person in the world.
No, I absolutely agree. And I mean, I actually wrote this little letter to the children of the future, and I was saying, I'm sorry that we couldn't be less greedy and couldn't be less selfish and couldn't do what was necessary in order to give you a future. You know, we couldn't just love each other enough to go, well, let's just actually see the good in each other and see what a fantastic gift it is to be here. You know we've got to find. Bring some loving here today, yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. And picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? Talk to me, so you can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh. Right on. Right on.
What is going on? The world just seems to be in a bad, unloving mood at the moment. talking about rights and wrongs on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, and talking to Nikki Smart, who used to live in Laguna and has now moved to Los Angeles. She decided to set up tent, as it were, at a bicycle cafe on the LA River called Spokes, and asked people what they felt about climate change. She said the first girl that approached her was a very condescending millennial who said she should be outside Starbucks instead of Spokes. But most people, she said, were really concerned and vacillating between hopelessness, denial, anger, and a kind of resignation. What can I do? She said the best encounters were with two young 8 and 9 year old girls who told her about their Halloween costumes and all the other fun things that they had coming up. She said that made her feel better about the world, which seems to have lost its moral core, doesn't it, right now?
Yeah.
And more than just thinking about it, we need to actually value it in concrete terms somehow. Mm-hmm. It needs to be taught at school.
I think so too.
It needs to be inculcated into us.
Changing the ideology.
Yeah. Right? We can role play at schools. We can have ethical discussions and there can be concrete examples. We can give them different scenarios and say, what is the quote, right way to behave in this situation, and have discussion about it. Because mm-hmm. there is no one right way, but at least teach them how to philosophically approach moral dilemma.
And, you know, as you were saying that with the children, I was going, I wonder what it's like to be a kid today and have this information that your future could be cut really short and that you actually can't. That would be interesting to know how this is going to affect the psyche of young people.
From what I hear, they're terrified, actually.
I would think so.
Because it's not just us positing.
Right. I mean, I've already had a nice, lovely, beautiful, long life. It's not that sad for me, but it's very sad for my daughter. And my daughter, you know, she's 29, and she's saying, Mom, I'm not going to have kids, because she doesn't think it would be right. And she said, I'd rather adopt children, which I'm all for, but I just think it's sad that they even have to think about things like that.
And that's... they do. I mean, I talk to so many young people about this, because this is all they know, basically. They haven't lived in a world without, say, the internet in their lives.
Right.
So you would think they wouldn't have the kind of perspectives that we have, but they do. They do know this course we're on right now is wrong. Mm. They, all of them know, all the ones I've talked to know, that this isn't how things should be. So I don't know how they know that. Maybe know it from their parents.
Maybe there's a hope in that they will actually take some action because they'll be motivated by something other than money.
They need the support of institutions, though, and they're not getting it.
Mm.
So unless they can somehow either create those institutions, or if they exist, be made aware of them and vote them into power, then I don't know how things are going to change. But I do feel we're on a precipice now, not just with global warming, but with everything, or the way that we're approaching life in general. As you say, it's about greed, it's about selfishness, it's about self-centeredness being rewarded rather than looked at askance.
Right. No, I agree, but I feel like we need to say something positive, though, too.
Yes, so please,
I don't know, I was hoping you might have something. Because okay,
I know that
people are feeling overwhelmed, just like we are feeling.
Yeah.
What is the positive takeaway?
Well, I actually have something positive about this era to impart. I'm Sharon James, by the way. You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm talking tonight to Nikki Smart. Nikki's just attended a 3-day seminar with Al Gore on climate change, and we've been talking about that, and we're talking more generally about right and wrong, morality, where we're going at the moment. We seem to have taken some wrong steps, but Nikki reminded me that we want something positive for you listeners.
I think the positive takeaway from all this is that we are aware of where we're being led by powerful institutions. We're being made aware of it through good journalism, through a new transparency that in our political arena, for good or bad, didn't quite exist before. We're seeing kind of the machinations of the political machinery, so we can maybe do something about it.
Right.
We are up in arms about these journalists being silenced or marginalized. whereas we took free speech for granted for the last 50 years. So I think this sudden awareness of all these problems, awareness of global warming, these people flying in from all over the world to try to create a posse of people who are going to make other people aware of all the problems, I think that that's all really useful and positive. I think the educational institutions need to take note of everything that's going on, and they need to somehow start at the very beginning with young kids, and they need to be informed. Can't have ignorant teachers. We need all the administrations on both sides of the coin to realize the importance of proper education with proper historical facts taught in schools. It shouldn't be a partisan thing.
Right. You know, the global warming is it's global. And I think the thing that gives me hope is the advances in like science. And I know there's people working on it right now, and they've come up with things like they found this enzyme that can eat plastic, and they found that they can take salt water and make it drinkable. And they're coming up with these amazing innovations. And that kind of gives me hope. I feel like that's where the answer is through innovation.
Right. But then everything has... I was just reading about these nets they have that can eliminate mosquitoes, that they're chemical nets. So, you know, then you're going to affect the atmosphere.
Yeah, don't do that.
But on the other hand, you're stopping malaria. So, I mean, if you think about the diseases that we've quelled in the past 50 years through chemicals, it's amazing. I mean, we've eradicated smallpox. We've eradicated a host of diseases that killed people in droves, and we're doing it through chemicals, so...
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the right way to go.
Well, and the point is that there are airborne diseases,
yes,
and they're spread by insects.
Yes,
and
yes. I mean, right now they have the typhoid fever.
True, but there again, there are many fewer deaths from typhoid than there were even 20 years ago. Fatality rate is down from between 10 and 20% to under 1%, statistics seem to suggest. And that's really due to vaccines and antibiotics to fight it. It's a whole other problem that the third world more than us have to contend with, where feces infect water supply. And Nikki and I just went to see a documentary in the making called Mr. Toilet, when one man is actually trying to bring toilets into certain third world countries where, believe it or not, the culture is in conflict to some extent, because having toilet facilities inside the house in which you sleep is considered more unhygienic than doing your business out in a field. And culture, of course, plays a large part in rights and wrongs. There are different standards for different parts of the world and different mechanisms for promoting ethical behaviour. Shaming, for instance, seems to be something that could work quite well universally. Seems to be something prominent in the East, but maybe we could use some of that in the West. I'm going to get into that a little bit more later, but the trouble with separating right from wrong is there isn't always clarity between what's right and what's wrong. There isn't always one right and one wrong. Which brings me to the trolley problem as an ethical jump-off position in the philosophy of ethics. My topic on tonight's KX935's The Share in Hour. You see a runaway trolley moving towards five incapacitated people. Maybe they're tied up onto the trolley tracks, or lame, or otherwise stuck there. The relevant part is you're standing next to a lever that controls a switch that can divert the trolley, where it will hit one person who's on that sidetrack, but it won't hit the five that it would have. You have two options. You can either allow the trolley to continue on the route it was on, it's going to kill five people, or you can take matters into your own hand and decide better to kill the one person than the five by pulling the lever and diverting the trolley. So, listener, which do you think is the most ethical option? Do something, do nothing. Opt to kill the one person by your human interference, or let destiny take its course? The answer largely depends on whether you're a proponent of utilitarianism, the philosophy established by Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, that your duty is to do what's best for the largest number of people. Or rather, since philosophy is pedantic, that the morally right action is the action that produces the most good. It might actually not be that it's for the most amount of people. Utilitarianism is basically an ethical theory of consequentialism, that the right ethical action is dictated by the consequences it produces, a kind of an end justifies the means ethics. But the concept of the right action being one that does the most good isn't necessarily quite as easy as it sounds, because how do you define good? Bentham and Stuart Mill defined it in terms of pleasure. They were hedonists, but they were also very democratic, so to them, everyone's happiness was equal. But as we know, in practice, that's not necessarily true. Often good is a zero-sum game. Sometimes your good means my bad, and my bad means your good. What's good for me isn't necessarily good for you, because we may not have equal status in the world. Utilitarianism had a somewhat more contemporary proponent in the philosopher Philippa Foot. Try saying that quickly, lots of times in a row. Philippa Foot was one of the founders of contemporary virtue ethics, inspired by the teachings of Aristotle. She was trying to modernize Aristotelian ethical theory to something that could fit a more contemporary worldview, with a little bit of the influence of favored philosopher Wittgenstein. As an aside, though she was British, she was actually the granddaughter of US President Grover Cleveland. Another aside, she once shared a flat with British novelist Iris Murdoch. If you happen to know and like Iris Murdoch, you maybe saw the film about her declining years called Iris. Anyway, I digress. Back to the problems that face us on a more quotidian level, as I resume my conversation with Nikki Smart on tonight's KX935's The Share and Hour.
We are trying to recycle. We do know that plastic is causing devastation in our oceans if we don't dispose of it correctly. I don't know about you, but I always cut open all those six-pack plastic things because birds get their beaks caught in between and die, and that seems horrible, and it's so easy just to cut them.
But it'd be even better if they just didn't make them in the first place.
Well, I mean, unfortunately,
convenience
is like huge in our civilization. I mean, look at the internet, is all, you know, really born of convenience. And it is incredibly convenient, and it has freed up our lives so that we can affect certain things that we couldn't affect before, and so is plastic.
Right.
So people, once they have the conveniences, are loath to give them up. And also, I mean, plastic can really be helpful. And, you know, if I have a party outside, I don't use glass because people can cut themselves if they tread on it.
And there's biodegradable plastics you can buy for stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that'll probably become more prevalent as well.
Right. But, I mean, they're made from petroleum, so we need to produce the oil. So it's, everything is so...
but here's the bottom line. If I'm having a party, I don't mind a glass smashing. I'd rather a glass smash than the oceans are getting full.
If a glass is smashing if I'm out on a patio and people are treading on it.
I'd still rather have them cut their foot than have the world end because we can't adapt, because we can't let go of our convenience. I'd rather let go of my convenience. I really would.
Well, it's not just convenience. It's safety. It's all sorts of different things.
Cheaper. I'm being your devil's advocate, fighting the opposite. Because everyone knows right now it's about fossil fuels. They know this, right? We know that this is happening. But if you say to someone, can you stop driving your car? No, they're not going to. Right? No one's going to. You stop eating meat? No, they're not going to.
Not going to because the infrastructure doesn't allow for it anymore.
So,
unfortunately, it's like if you told them, the film we saw yesterday, do you want a toilet or do you want your cell phone? Because in fact, they cannot, as one of them said, we can't in the modern day exist without it.
Right.
And we can't. And that's because these huge institutions are making us dependent on it because it serves their purpose. And at the very top levels of government, they're being supported because money is everything. So
it's enormous to shift people's
And also, I mean, and
difficult.
It's not just convenience, plastic versus glass.
No,
you know, it's
not.
Cheaper
to
produce.
If I go to the coffee shop, I take my own mug. I take my own cup so I can have my own water and stuff like that. But it is very inconvenient, and I don't always remember to do it. But the only way people will do that, I think, is if the coffee shop doesn't give you coffee in a paper cup anymore or a plastic cup. They just go, we don't have those. So you bring your own, you have to drink it here, right?
Well, you've just brought up, actually, there's a new element that people are proposing, and it exists in lots of cultures, and that's shaming. And They think that that is the only way we're going to change our bad habits, is from a culture of shaming.
Mm-hmm.
Many cultures, Eastern cultures, have that, where they shame you into behaving correctly.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay
with that.
I think
it's the only, it's probably the only way. But in order to feel ashamed, you can't have a leader saying, I didn't pay my taxes, that's clever. As opposed to, I didn't pay my taxes, thereby, maybe we can't fix the roads because we don't have the money. Maybe we can't send kids to school because we don't have the money. So in order to have a culture of shame, you need
to
have
a base,
the base knowledge of what the right thing is.
Yeah.
So if you could create the ideal world, what would it be? Let me ask you that. Seriously, if you were in charge of what the world could be, where would you start? What would you do?
Oh my gosh. Well, firstly, I'd make sure that there's gender parity across all the leadership positions. It's not just men running the place and running the show. And get young voices in there too, because I think the future generations, they're important.
So yeah. that's just voting, and you can do that right
away.
Yes, but what would you be voting for?
I would absolutely, like you said, try and change the ideology that it's not just about money. It's about quality of life, and it's about, I mean, to me, the basic thing is love, right? I think love is the most important thing in any walk of life, in anything.
So how do you inculcate that from the get-go, from the birth?
I think it's from the first moment.
And how do you do it?
Well, first of all, you have to be loving yourself so that you can actually love this little person that's come to you.
And what if you're not? Because you didn't have it in your, it wasn't
right,
in your
well,
portfolio,
there you go.
As it were.
And then lies the problem, because that's why we are where we are today. Because a lot of people aren't loved, and then they keep perpetuating that cycle onto their kids. And there's just there was a song a long time ago in the 70s or 80s, and it said, because there's not enough love to go around. And I remember that really speaking to me then. And it would make me cry, because I went, it's so true. There just isn't.
Now when you climb into your bed tonight, and when you lock and bolt the door, just think of those out in the cold and dark. 'Cause there's not enough love to go around. And sympathy is what we need, my friend. And sympathy is what we need. And sympathy is what we need. Cause there's not enough love to go around. No, there's not enough love to go around. Now half the world hates the other half, and half the world has all the food, and half the world lies down and quietly starves. 'Cause there's not enough love to go around. And sympathy is what we need, my friend. And sympathy is what we need. And sympathy is what we need, my friend. 'Cause there's not enough love to go around. No, there's not enough love to go around.
But wouldn't it be amazing if we had this world that was just full of love? That would be my ideal, yes, what I would love.
Right.
And, you know,
but if it were full of love, we wouldn't even know what love was. So the only reason we know what love is because there's the opposite.
Yeah, but then let's get a balance. But I think right now, if it's love and fear is the opposite of love, right? And right now we're just in fear and we're deeply in fear in almost every aspect and we have to somehow shift it back into love. But how? That's the question.
That is the question. Ethics is the topic of my share and hour tonight with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. And my guest tonight, my friend Nikki Smart, suggests that love is at the root of it all, which is probably true. But as we were just saying, love and examples of peaceful coexistence doesn't always sell as well as fear-mongering.
People have a vested interest in making us fearful, unfortunately.
Well, it does sell more copies of magazines and newspapers and TV shows.
Even now, when we're watching something, a lovely, loving drama, the news will come on and it won't be the news of the day. It'll be a promo for the news coming up and it'll use all the disasters that happened last month, little snippets of them, to make us want to watch the news at 11 o'clock.
Right, but when you pull back from the earth and you go, okay, so here's this little earth, which is this pinprick in the middle of infinity, to just relax a little into it and just go, it's okay. It's okay, we're a little pinprick in the middle of infinity. It's okay. Nothing's really changed about that situation.
Right. Well, how far afield does your love take you? Does it take you to the untouchables in India? Does it take you to the homeless?
I think it takes you yes.
And then what do you do with it? That's the terrible thing. If you do allow your heart to open to all of these people and then you still have to step over them or move on with your immediate circle, or
I think it's just it's a consciousness. It's like I can step over this person and in my head go, oh God, they're disgusting, or in my head go, I send you love.
But you're still stepping over them.
Yes, but I'm stepping over it with what my frame of mind is when I'm doing it. And sure, I can help maybe, but you can't help everyone because the problem's too enormous, right? There's too much going on. But I think no matter what problem is you're facing, if you can do it with a loving approach instead of an angry approach or a fearful approach, maybe that helps.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
It's easy to say that, but I feel such anger sometimes. I feel complete rage, and I don't know where to put that rage. Right now, I sort of let it out on Facebook by making nasty comments at people, and I go, well,
that's the trouble, everyone's doing that.
Yeah,
and it's also putting that out. Right. I remember my husband saying when I would rant about something, and he would get all red in the face and upset, and I said, I'm not asking you to fix it. He said, yeah, but you're putting something into the room that
which is true.
Toxic, because I can see how upset and angry you are. And he's absolutely right.
That's what I'm saying. So it's up to us to not put that out, right? And try and turn it into love. Now that we can do.
Yes.
As an individual, that is something that is very possible and just takes a little bit of self-awareness and possibly meditating and just being calm.
Yeah.
And I know it's hard in this time. It's very hard because there's just so much going on that is, like you said, it's terrifying. So it's just staying afloat. And I mean, at the end of the day, and I got to say, and this is really from my heart, I actually do feel hopeful. As overwhelmed as I feel, I also underneath there's a current of hopefulness.
I think it's because we've been turned inside out and we're looking at the dark side
of our humanity.
And
I think humans will step up because I believe in the good in us. I do think that it will prevail. I think that people want to do the right thing. But yeah, hopefully this will open everyone's eyes to pulling together as a human race. I mean, we're one entity. But yeah, and to me, it really is the only comfort I can find, actually, is to pull back far away enough that I can go, it's okay. On a spiritual level, it's okay. Maybe, yeah, like you're saying, it's a test. We're always going through things. There's cycles. And you're right. If it was all just happy, happy, love, 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 we wouldn't know that because we'd have nothing to counteract it. Yeah. And I love that you said we're turning inside out and we're seeing that dark part of ourselves. Yes, maybe this is our time that we need to see that, become aware of it, to elevate ourselves. I like that.
The dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker. We kill the flame. Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker. Hey, nay, 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 nay. I'm ready, my lord. There's a lover in the story, but the story's still the same. There's a lullaby for suffering and a paradox to blame. But it's written in the scriptures and it's not some idle claim. You want it darker. We kill the flame. They're lining up the prisoners and the guards are taking aim. I struggled with some demons, they were middle class and tame. I didn't know I had permission to murder and to maim. You want it darker? Hey, nay, 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 nay. I'm ready, my lord. Sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the love that never came. You want it darker. We kill the flame. If you are the dealer, let me out of the game. If you are the healer, I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, mine must be the shame. You want it darker. Hey, nay, 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 nay.
Amazing Leonard Cohen, always good for poetic social commentary. He spent his dying days working on that song with his son Adam. Ethics is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. We are a listener-supported, member-supported FM public radio station. So if you're not a member, do consider joining. Go to our website, kx935.com, for details, or call our station at 949-715-4859. Because we are local, we do have emergency alerts, so that's a good enough reason to keep staying tuned. You may have Alert OC or Nixie on your phone, but sometimes the airwaves don't work locally, where our radio antenna does. So if you're local and something is going on that you need to know about, you'll learn it here. Other things on our website are all our shows. This one is The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, currently playing on Monday nights at 9 instead of my old time slot of Sunday night at 6. Hope you'll still stay tuned for it. Our website is currently advertising a show we have coming up on Saturday, December 8th with Nancy Wilson. Being the age I am, when I saw Nancy Wilson, I thought it was my Nancy Wilson, the jazz Nancy Wilson. But I Googled her and I thought, my God, she looks good for 81. And she looks white. So obviously it's not the Nancy Wilson that I thought it was. It's the rock guitarist Nancy Wilson. But I'm going to close the show, being a jazz aficionado, with my Nancy Wilson. And since I've been talking about love on tonight's The Sharon Hour, which was about ethics, but you can't have ethics without love for your fellow man. It's a schmaltzy song sung by anyone else, but I love it, and Nancy Wilson's rendering of it is a bit more palatable than Mario Lanza's. So here you go, with Be My Love, the other Nancy Wilson.
For no one else can end this yearning, this need that you and you alone create. Just fill my arms the way you fill my dreams, the dreams that you inspire with sweet desire. Be my love, and with your kisses set me burning. One kiss is all I need to seal my fate, and hand in hand we'll find love's promised land. There'll be no one but you for me eternally. You will be my love. Love.
So that's it, dear listener, for my share in our tonight. If you want to hear this show again, you can do so on iTunes or go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. I'm Sharon James, wishing you a great week ahead, and do please come back and listen to more topics, concepts, interviews and music every Monday night at 9.